This week in Retronauts, the shadow and the flame in this economy. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, sounding a lot more alive and excited than I am. I'm not saying that I'm not excited, but I am saying that I'm not necessarily alive, because that's just how it goes. This is episode 705, but those of you who love Metroidvania games will know this as episode 1 of chapter 2 of the Metroidvania Book Club. We are talking about The Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown. So many articles. Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, a very recent Metroidvania game in defiance of the Retronauts Retroid. Yes, that one. Wow. Good times.
I like Retroid a lot.
Someone else is, there's actually another entity out there called Retroids. So can't do that one. The Retronauts Metroidvania. Yes, okay. The Retronauts thing is about game history. This game is not necessarily a part of history, so we are going to devote a segment of this conversation to talking about the history behind The Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, because I think that it is relevant to what this game is about. But we will also be discussing the Metroidvania aspect of it, and we're going to talk about essentially-ish the first half of the game this episode, and then there will be a follow-up episode where we talk about the second half of the game. And if you were here for the first two Metroidvania Book Club conversations we had about Castlevania Order of Ecclesia, you will know that this is a community endeavor, and those of you who are awesome enough to be part of the Retronauts, not Metroidnauts, the Retronauts Discord, have already been discussing the first half-ish of this game, and in fact, we are going to incorporate some of your remarks into the back portion of this episode. But before we do all of those things, I would like for this episode's sponsor of sorts to kind of walk us through what this is all about. Actually, maybe before we do that, we should all introduce ourselves. I've just been talking, sucking the oxygen out of the room. So let's work our way around to the sponsor and start instead with Stuart. Please introduce yourself. I gave it away already.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Stuart. Let me flip the hourglass. Okay, Stuart Jip. There we go. That was my comical reference.
I know. Every time we mess up, we're going to be like, no. That's not how it went. But that's not really this. That's not really what this, the Prince of Persia that this episode is about, but that's okay. Chris, introduce yourself.
Hi, Jeremy. It's Chris Sims.
Hey, Chris.
Back once again. Can't wait to talk about all the great games from 1995.
There's going
to
be some serious Spider-Man in this. You could justify talking about some Spider-Man games in relation to the Prince of Persia. Actually, he's not the prince. In relation to Sargon's athletic wall climbing and sliding prowess, I think you could sneak some references in there.
I'm just so looking forward to talking about how you unlock Kron Hunter mode in Area 51. It was a big part of my childhood, and I was really looking forward to talking about it here on Retronauts.
Area 51, famously a major part of Persia. And then finally, our sponsor for this episode, please introduce yourself and also tell us what's up with this pick of a game.
Hello, I'm Kate Willard, and I decided to break the Retronauts rules by give you guys a choice. I was like, let's go more retro, or what if we go modern? And in terms of like why I picked this one for a modern one is because I just, of all like the more recent Metroidvanias, this is the one that I've enjoyed the most recently. Like, I enjoyed this more than Metroid Dread. And I admit a big part of that is because I really liked how the numerous difficulty settings let you customize the experience to your play style. I am a fan of Prince of Persia's place in video game history. And that's why I was excited about the game when it was first announced. Like, whoa, Prince of Persia has a Metroidvania. It's like two tastes that go great together. Is that how it goes? Yeah.
Something like that. Okay. So, Metroidvania fans, can enjoy a Prince of Persia game. Prince of Persia fans can enjoy a Metroidvania game. Maybe. We'll see. I agree about the difficulty options. That was a deal saver for me when I started playing this game. I'm sure there will be lots of different opinions about the role of difficulty in a game like this. I'm sure Stuart and I probably sit on opposite ends of that spectrum.
Yes.
So that'll be a fun debate to have.
But I'm looking forward to having a difficulty discourse. That's not going to be tedious for anyone.
that's my favorite thing about video games these days. That and people saying, oh, this thing was constrained by time and money. The developers must be so lazy. I love when they do that. That's cool.
I'm just, never mind. That wasn't the joke I was going to make. I think it went more like this.
All right, so you know that little joke we keep referencing about Prince of Persia: The Sands of Time. The first time I ever actually saw that in a video game was in Xenogears, of all places. There's like a sequence where you have to jump onto a moving train, and if you get it wrong, then all of a sudden it's like, no, that's not how this event went, and it rewinds it. And you start over, and it's really out of place in that game. And it's very strange that it suddenly became like a thing games started to do later.
Was that before or after Eternal Darkness? Because whenever you guys are bringing this up, I just keep going, this can't be happening.
I think I first saw it in Pitman on the Game Boy, but I think that's just a normal rewind.
Yeah, I mean, Pitman definitely, or Cat Trap, I believe, is the preferred nomenclature for us Westerners. Yeah, Cat Trap / Pitman did have a rewind feature, which was maybe the first instance of that in a game, and basically said, oh, you messed up a puzzle 100 steps in, you don't have to do all 100 steps, just rewind X number of steps. And that was great.
Great game.
But there was no narrative to it. The cat people were not saying, no, those weren't the commands I meant to do.
They were in my head, Jeremy.
Oh, okay. Well, I cannot speak to the cat people speaking to you inside of your brain. That's something special and unique to you. So Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, debuted last year, 2024, on pretty much every system, I believe. I don't know. I've been playing it on Switch, and I'm not really aware of other video game systems at this point. So I'm going to assume it was on all systems. Am I? Yes, no?
I was playing it on Steam.
Okay.
Yes.
That is not a system. It is a platform, but good enough.
I was playing it on Steam Deck.
Oh, okay. That's a
platform. There we go.
A system. Yeah. A platform system. Anyway, so yeah. I mean, Ubisoft, the developer and publisher, they always throw entire armies of people at games, and so they need to monetize them to the best of their ability. So it stands to reason that this showed up on every platform under the sun. I do think games like this are pretty well suited to a portable system, though. Just something feels right about a portable Metroidvania. Maybe that's just conditioning. So it is a Metroidvania game. It is a really big budget Metroidvania game, just based on graphics and play mechanics and the amount of voice acting and the options for voice acting and script and so forth. There's a lot of narrative for a game like this, and you can enjoy it in many different languages. So yeah, it was a spared no expense kind of thing, which is never a good omen when you hear someone say it like that, but they spared no expense. And unfortunately, even though the game sold really, really well and received excellent reviews, Ubisoft said it didn't sell well enough. And so they got rid of the team behind it or reassigned them to other projects so that they could, you know, make pottery for an Assassin's Creed game or something. And we'll never see another one of these. We'll never see the likes of this one again. But we do have this one, and that's great. And, you know, I think this game, in addition to being a pretty interesting and largely kind of open-ended take on the Metroidvania, also does a really good job of incorporating elements from across the entirety of the Prince of Persia franchise. And that's no mean feat. I'm curious where everyone here stands on the whole concept of Prince of Persia. Kate, I know you said you're a fan.
Well, I'm a fan of the first one, but to be honest, I have not played anything else that has come after, including the big, you know, Sands of whatever stuff. I have this huge gap in my gaming experience, like that is awkwardly like so.
That's 35 years.
Like the GameCube era, I was in college. And so during that era, I played maybe a total of like 5 games that I can remember. And then I had to hear them all about all these other ones after the fact. Like I was not like even playing Halo much other than playing a demo once in a GameStop and things like that. I had to go back and backtrack a lot of that era.
As is only appropriate for the Metroidvania format.
Exactly.
That's honestly very funny to me because when I think back to the GameCube era when I was in college, I played a lot of video games, but I also did not complete college. So
yeah.
I think maybe that's the difference.
I felt that choice and I was like, oh, I need to finish college.
Yeah, it's funny. I left for college and deliberately did not bring my Super NES with me because I'm old. I said I need to not take a video game system with me so I can just focus on school. And then after the first semester, I went home for Christmas break and Secret of Mana came out and I played it. I rented it and was like, oh, you know what? I don't want to not play video games. So it was just a thing. I took my Super NES back with me and played video games all through college, and I got through okay. My issue was that I spent too much time working on the student newspaper and stuff, so I graduated a semester late because I was like, I don't need to take a full course load. I could just go and work on the student newspaper because I'm a dork. What about you, Stuart? What happens when you think of GameCube in college? What comes to your mind?
I don't think they really synchronized for
what?
Me. I did play a lot of Prince of Persia on DOS, the original DOS version. I never finished it, obviously, but I played it a fair amount. And the second one I played on my friend's Macintosh, but we didn't have the passwords to, you know, they had like the copy protection. So you'd have to guess between 1 of 5 symbols. And sometimes we'd get onto level 2 and it was really exciting because we'd guess the correct one. But, we never got through it because it's really hard. As for all the other stuff, yeah, Sands of Time and all of those, I enjoyed them, but I sort of fell off it after that because they just kept making them. They kept rebooting it and then unrebooting it, and I was just kind of like, oh, I've got other stuff to play, you know. But I like all of them, and I'm going to mention this because I think this is the best time to do it, that there was actually a Sands of Time Metroidvania, the GBA version, and it's surprisingly similar to this one, to Lost Crown. There's stuff in this that's kind of borrowed from that. And I don't think enough people have played it, and I think that they should. It's really rather good.
Oh,
yeah, actually, that was something that I was reminded of when I was putting together notes for this, is that there were, in addition to the big-budget Prince of Persia games that were, you know, full 3D on consoles, they did come out with some portable spin-offs that were sometimes pretty much a direct conversion as much as possible, like on PSP. But then you did have, you know, the GameCube, Xbox to Game Boy Advance pipeline where they said, you know what, let's not even try. And they just went with the classic style. And Ubisoft did a lot of those. There were like 2D Splinter Cell games and Assassin's Creed games. And those were actually not very good. So I have to admit, I never played... Oh, do you want to stand up for Splinter Cell on Game Boy Advance? I want to stand up for
Vicarious Visions 2D Splinter Cell. Not the other stuff, but I will stand behind those games because I thought they were pretty darn good. That's just, you know, but it's me. It's me. I'm going to like this kind of stuff, you know?
Fair, fair.
You know.
Yeah, so I was always pretty suspicious of those. Hey, it's a pre-rendered graphics Game Boy Advance 2D take on a much more popular and much more impressive looking game. But, you know, sometimes they turned out okay. Mm. Consider Ninja 5-0, the spinoff of a game that didn't even exist. That's how good it was. It erased the existence of whatever console
Ninja
game it was
4-9.
Going to tie into. Yes, that one. And so, you know, let's
you know the other like big like gap in my gaming history that I had I've slowly been trying to fix is that I was always like a console kid. So Prince of Persia I heard of just because it was big enough to eventually, you know, like I think I first saw it at somebody else's house who had a computer, but I didn't have a computer. Computers were for rich people. And then, like, later, I couldn't afford a handheld either, so I missed out on... That's why I missed out on all the handheld Castlevania games that I'm trying to, like, go back and do eventually, is that, like, if it's console... And then even console, Nintendo kid. So, Nintendo family, we had all the Nintendo consoles. I missed out on, like, Metal Gear Solid and stuff like that, because we couldn't afford a PlayStation.
That's okay. You played Twin Snakes, right?
Right. Yeah, I did play Twin Snakes.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's no way to experience Metal Gear.
I know. I should correct that.
Play
one day.
Revengeance, the only Metal Gear game I've played.
It's a good choice, though. It's a great game.
So Prince of Persia, the series, began 1989, 35 years before The Lost Crown appeared. It started out on Apple II, but it was so popular, despite launching on Apple... Actually, no, I think it was pretty much a dud, like dead on arrival when it shipped on Apple II, because who owned an Apple II in 1989 for gaming? Like, no one. But the quality was there, and it was a very portable game, so like in terms of ports... So they transported it to basically any system that they could possibly manage. I'm pretty sure there was an NES version, definitely Super NES, Genesis, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's one of those that has kind of remained viable throughout the years. So it's shown up on many collections and so forth. None of those games, I think, those different ports looked quite as good as the Macintosh version. That was like double resolution for everything. And they like totally redrew the graphics and gave it lots of color. Everything else was like half the resolution of the Mac version. So in a way, that's kind of the definitive version of Prince of Persia, the original, just because
some people would swear by the Konami Super Nintendo version, cause they expanded it so much with like really gorgeous pixel art and stuff. But, I would say they probably expanded it too much in some ways and you lose some of the essential, sort of clarity of the game, but I just thought it should merit a mention because it is so different.
Kate, I know this one is a big game for you, as you mentioned earlier. Do you want to kind of walk us through what made Prince of Persia unique back in the day?
Well, so the roots of Prince of Persia really go back to a game called Karateka, which was by the same author, Jordan Mechner, where you kind of run through or walk through these levels and fight people one-on-one. move on to the next guy, trying to rescue the damsel in distress. It was considered very cinematic because he rotoscoped all of the movements and the fights and things like that, which just like blew people away. People hadn't seen like movements looking this fluid on the Apple II. I mean, when you think of Apple II and you think of like Oregon Trail, like you don't think of like, oh, fluid anything. So it blew people away, and then it took forever for him to properly follow it up, and that became Prince of Persia. Similarly rotoscoped, but he added like platforming and things like that. And the type of platforming, instead of being like fast, like twitchy platforming like you might be used to from like Donkey Kong or whatever, it's this slower, deliberate platforming, because the fluid animation, basically, once you press an action button, you have to commit because that animation takes over. You're doing the jump now, or the run, or what have you. And this resulted in sort of a whole subgenre that's sometimes referred to as the cinematic platformer, that is like all this fluid animation platforming with puzzle elements. Games like Flashback and later like Oddworld and debatedly Another World. I do not consider Another World in that realm because there isn't actually much platforming in it. It's more of a cinematic adventure game. Like if you took a point and click and removed the point and click and had like rotoscoped looking fluid animation, you know. But some people like to lump it in because it's got that similar look and vibe. So
there's something very French about this style of game. Like I feel like most of the big games come from French developers, like Delphine, yeah. Who created Flashback. There was Heart of Darkness. I can't remember the name of the studio behind that. I know Mechner has some sort of affinity for France. And French culture, because I know if you look up, how do you pronounce his name? He's said the American way of saying it is Mechner, but if you're saying it, you know, the way it would be said in France, it'd be Mechner. But then he says, you know, it's actually like a Germanic root. So I don't know. It's all muddled in there, but you get France somehow. And of course, Ubisoft is a French company, making Prince of Persia. So yeah, it just seemed like this kind of beautiful animation priority type gameplay kind of took root in France. And the French pop culture has a great affinity for animation and for graphic novels or bande dessinée, if you want to call it that. So it kind of fits. But yeah. Prince of Persia did really stand out from other platforming games of the time. I've been trying to think of, like, were there any other platformers like this that were very sort of slow and precise where, you know, you really had to pay attention to the animation and kind of think a move ahead for your actions because everything was sort of a commitment. I mean, you had, like, Ghosts and Goblins that kind of did that, but not in terms of the animation priority, just like you were very limited in terms of your controls. So, you know, when you made a jump or something, it was kind of a commitment and you had to really mean it. But the way it worked in Prince of Persia was different. And the emphasis in Prince of Persia, the original, was not on combat. It was really on puzzle platforming. I mean, you did occasionally fight like skeletons and stuff. It had that kind of Voyages of Sinbad, Ray Harryhausen kind of vibe to it with some of the animation. But those were just sort of incidental. Like those were kind of like in Karateka or Karateka. If you think back to that, like you were kind of moving forward and every encounter you came up against was meaningful and significant and really tested your skills. And Prince of Persia, the original, was very much like that. And on top of that, you couldn't dawdle because the entire game had a 60-minute time limit. You had to reach the end and rescue the princess from the evil vizier Jafar before, I don't know, he married her or, you know, the hourglass ran out and they turned into frogs. I don't know exactly what happens. because the game ends and you feel bad because you've wasted an hour and you didn't win. But yeah, a very cool looking game, and one that really kind of reinvented what it meant to be a platform action game. So Prince of Persia was ported to lots of systems, and also it spawned sequels. The first sequel came in 1993. It was called Prince of Persia 2, The Shadow and the Flame, and it was pretty much the same game, except with way more combat, a slightly longer deadline, but a bigger game too, so not actually any easier. And I think the main gimmick to the game is kind of what you see in the title, which is that at one point in the original Prince of Persia, you kind of face off against your magically animated shadow. And that becomes like a, you know, it's kind of just like an incidental, whoa, that's cool sort of thing in the original. But in the sequel, that becomes a core game mechanic. And you have like a shadow version of you that you need to manipulate in order to solve puzzles and things like that. So it kind of reminds me of like Oddworld, where you can chant to possess the slug guards, whatever they're called, sligs, and, you know, make them fart and whatever. So yeah, like I kind of feel, you know, like that, that kind of laid the groundwork for, the Oddworld games in another sense, but generally a pretty good game, not as successful and groundbreaking as the first, but still, you know, showed up on a lot of systems and sold very, very well. Kate, I don't know. You mentioned that you didn't play any of the sequels, so that includes Prince of Persia 2?
That includes that one, yeah.
Chris, are you on board with any of these older Prince of Persia games?
My experience of seeing Prince of Persia, like the original flavor Prince of Persia, was very much like reading about it in magazines at the time. I think it was on, if anybody remembers Flux Magazine, which was a magazine about comic books, video games, and specifically heavy metal. The greatest publication of all time. I think they did like a top 100 video games of all time. And I remember like going through that list over and over, because like Kate, I was very much a console kid, a Nintendo kid specifically. I have always considered the Sega Genesis to be the province of the wealthy. And, you know, PC gaming, why? That doesn't even connect to your TV. Why would you even do that? And even to this day, like, I play games on Steam, on Steam Deck, because that is a console. But I just have this, like, loop in my head of, like, the animation of climbing a ledge and slowly standing up. And, like, thinking, like, oh, that looks like the Aladdin game for Super Nintendo, which is a very good-looking game. But yeah, I never got around to playing those. So it was one of those things where I kind of had to use my imagination to sort of figure out what this game was about. So I assumed it was a lot of climbing up ledges.
I think I
was right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my first one was Sands of Time, which I liked. And I feel like, kind of ironically, I never played any of the sequels, because I remember that being like a big reboot of the franchise for the new modern console generation. But I never played any of the sequels because I feel like everything that I wanted to do in that game and enjoyed doing that game, I ended up liking in Assassin's Creed instead. Stabbing dudes.
I do feel like, I mean, you stab dudes a lot in the 3D Prince of Persia games, but
yeah, but I think Assassin's Creed, you probably stab the most dudes stabbed in a video.
There's a lot less friction for stabbing dudes in Assassin's Creed. It's kind of like press button to murder people.
What is the TTSD rating on that? The time to stabbing dudes
in Assassin's Creed? I think it's pretty quick, depending on the game. Sometimes you jump right in and you're just like popping guys.
TTSD in the whole series would be Prince of Persia 2. Like, you break out of a window and you got to turn around, and if you're not stabbing, you'll just immediately die. You got to stab straight away. It's incredible.
ABS, always be stabbing. Very similar to this game, where it's always be slashing.
Thank you.
So, oh, that's right. We are talking about the Lost Crown. Yeah, so after Prince of Persia and Prince of Persia 2, lots of other people said, this is a good idea. We should make games along these lines. And you got like Flashback. And then Flashback gave us Fade to Black, which was taking the style of game into 3D, much less of the platforming. They weren't quite sure what they wanted to do. But that's okay, because the following year, Eidos and Core Designs figured it out with Tomb Raider and basically made Prince of Persia, but in 3D with a cute lady as the protagonist.
What it shares, I think, with just to be quick about it, sorry, both Tomb Raider and the 2D Prince of Persia games feel like they have grid-based sort of movement. Mm-hmm. Like with Prince of Persia, you tap, say, right, you will do a full step to the right and stop. But if you're holding, say, shift, you'll do a half step. And everything's built around that, the exact distances. And Tomb Raider is the same. Like, I think Prince of Persia even has the sort of hold the button so you don't just walk off the edge of a ledge thing. It really is just a 3D take on Prince of Persia, but with a lot more slaying of exotic creatures.
But not actually that much in the first Tomb Raider. Like the amount of killing you do in the original Tomb Raider is pretty modest compared to the later games.
Oh yeah, even compared to like 2 when it goes to the moon.
Yeah,
Tomb Raider's...
2 is like suddenly Lara's bloodthirsty Bloodcroft.
Yeah, Tomb Raider strikes me as somebody going like, what if the Pitfall series was a Prince of Persia, but in 3D and a girl, like
pretty much. It's, I feel like Indiana Jones.
I feel like having to press a button to not step off a ledge speaks to a fundamental misunderstanding of human beings.
Mm.
Like, I'm not saying you shouldn't be allowed to step off the ledge. I'm just saying maybe that is a decision you make on purpose, as most people tend to avoid it.
I couldn't say I try to avoid ledges when I possibly can. But anyway, Tomb Raider was a pretty big deal. And so 3 years later, when they decided, oh, we should do a 3D Prince of Persia for the game called Prince of Persia 3D, the developer, Mindscape, basically made it Tomb Raider, but kind of uglier. I don't know. I never really got the appeal of Prince of Persia 3D. It just felt like it kind of missed the things that made Prince of Persia great, but also wasn't as good at being Tomb Raider as Tomb Raider was.
It has like the worst controls, especially on PC. I think it was Arabian Nights on Dreamcast, and even there it's like you just play any Tomb Raider over it. It's a shame because I do quite like some of the later sort of stages. There's some really fun, like ridiculously narrow platforms, and that's the kind of thing I enjoy. But it's really, you're fighting the controls basically the whole time, which is not the case on Tomb Raider, generally speaking.
But I think it's worth mentioning that, in my opinion, Prince of Persia 3D is where you start to see the seeds for what became the Lost Crown, because the protagonist has not just a sword, but twin blades, and also a bow that is not used for combat, but for solving puzzles. So, like, this is where they start to just kind of say, what are elements that we could, you know, use for the Lost Crown and make this fundamentally Prince of Persia-ish? Which is interesting, because Prince of Persia 3D obviously is where the series diverges from the 2D platformer style and moves into 3D platforming and combat. But the Lost Crown kind of takes basically 25 years of 3D Prince of Persia game design and condenses it all into a 2D action game. So you kind of start to see, like, this is where you start the hourglass, I guess. I was going to say the clock, but I guess it should be an hourglass. Yeah. So anyway, Mechner wasn't super happy with the way the game turned out and decided to step away from the franchise and game development. I think also he was discouraged by how The Last Express did, which was to say not very well at all. And so he held on to the property rights, the IP rights for Prince of Persia, but said, I'm not going to mess with the game anymore. So the games belonged to Bruderbund, which was purchased by the Learning Company, which was then acquired by, I can't remember. Anyway, rights bounced around and they eventually ended up with Ubisoft. And so Ubisoft said, we should do something with this cool property we have, you know, access to. So they reached out to Mechner and got him on board and said, we're going to do something that's actually good with Prince of Persia, and I guess sent him the storyboards or whatever. And he was like, you know what? I'm a story guy and I like these storyboards. Let's go for it. And so we end up with The Sands of Time, a complete reinvention of the series that really kind of, I kind of feel like this and Beyond Good and Evil is sort of the beginning of modern Ubisoft. I suppose also Splinter Cell. You have just like these franchises that kind of hit in the PS2, GameCube, Xbox era. And all of a sudden Ubisoft went from being like, who are these guys? Zombie, what's that? To, you know, to all of a sudden being like a major player. And, you know, you see a lot of good ideas come out here. And you also see Prince of Persia succumb to some of the things that plague Ubisoft even now, such as the fact that The Sands of Time had multiple sequels a year after each other. Whereas the original Prince of Persia took like 4 years for them to make another sequel. So the good and the bad. But I would say The Sands of Time is wildly successful as a game. I've been talking a lot, so I'm going to throw it over to someone else who loves The Sands of Time. Hopefully someone on here. Yes?
I like it.
But do you love it?
No.
Really?
I like it. It's fine. I've never gone back to it. I played it. I enjoyed it when it came out, but it's not a game that I, other than the comedy of the way the game responds to you dying by being like, no, hang on. because of course it is, you know, it is framed as a story being told by the protagonist, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal. So I thought that was a really fun element to it, because it is hilarious to imagine telling a story and then being like, yeah, then I died.
No, wait, yeah,
it was wild. I fell down a hole and died.
Yeah, they sort of look at his hands as like, oh, no, wait.
Oh, wait, no, sorry, I had that wrong. Another guy died. I was different. I was way better than that guy. But yeah, like, it's not one that I go back to. And it's interesting to me that there is kind of like, you know, Prince of Persia is maybe not like a major franchise in the way that, you know, Assassin's Creed is or Castlevania is for me. Even though Castlevania is currently an inactive major franchise, but it's weird that there is a franchise out there that, like, I've certainly enjoyed the pieces that I've played, but that I do not think about at all.
Fair enough.
I think that The Sands of Time was a bit of a sort of bridge to, I don't want to say like to next gen, but it did a lot of things more cinematically than similar games were doing them before, like prior to that. Sort of stuff that is quite commonplace now, like running into a room and getting a kind of pan over this enormous space and thinking to yourself, okay, I've got to get up there. How am I going to use whatever elements I have at my disposal to do it? Because it did focus so much on clambering and little on killing. I mean, when you are killing in this game, that's when it's at its least interesting, I think. It's not like horrible or anything, but it's just, I'm always finding myself thinking, when can I get back to like swinging on a pole, you know? I guess that's kind of why the sequel didn't set the world on fire quite so much, because they doubled down on the killing. But I thought this was a really interesting game. It was cinematic in the way that games are cinematic now. While the original Prince of Persia was just cinematic, if that makes any sense. So they weren't doing anything particularly new, but they were doing it differently, and that did stand out at the time. The sense of scale and the setting was not a common setting, you know, for a video game, I don't think, at that point. So it was nice to have something that did feel a bit different. And it's still fun to go back to, I think. But it's not like, I don't think it's like 10 out of 10. It's too much fighting. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I would say The Sands of Time stands out more for what it meant when it debuted. Like, it was very, I feel very different from anything around it, and it really kind of made you stop and say, oh, this is interesting. Like, it figured out sort of 3D action crowd management in a way that other games really, really struggled to do at this point in 2003. And yeah, like, it, as you said, it's cinematic in the way games are now. It's like the original Prince of Persia was cinematic in a silent film kind of way. Mm-hmm. And The Sands of Time was like, let's not do that. Let's just jump ahead straight to the post Lord of the Rings era of filmmaking. So it just feels like, you know, you kind of skipped over a century of filmmaking tradition there, for better and for worse. But, you know, I would say the way it kind of seamlessly blended the 3D combat with the 3D exploration much more successfully than other games had done before. I mean, you look at the Tomb Raider games from that era, and, you know, the platforming in Tomb Raider was always really good and really strong, and the combat was always really bad and never got better until, you know, they kind of took it away from Core and gave it to Crystal Dynamics. And this was before that. So you can look at the fight scenes in this game and really sort of see, like, oh, this is going to be Assassin's Creed in a few years, or Arkham Asylum. Well. Yeah. Yeah. It's, well, I mean, Uncharted is much more about ranged combat, you know, cover-based combat, I would say, and stealth kills, but this is more of the melee style. So it does feel like a direct through line to me to Assassin's Creed. And it's kind of ironic that Assassin's Creed eventually supplanted Prince of Persia, and Prince of Persia never really found its stride after Assassin's Creed kicked off, as much as they tried to do that. But also relevant to The Lost Crown, this is the first game that has a time manipulation mechanic. I mean, time was a big factor in the first games, in the sense that you were trying to outrun the clock. But instead of making time basically your enemy in The Sands of Time, it turns time into your ally, your comrade, your friend. You have the ability to use the magic dagger to rewind time up to 10 seconds. And then as you gain more powers, you can do new things, like you can freeze an enemy or all the enemies, or you can slow time to make it easier to get through some of the puzzle platform sequences, or just to kind of get the upper hand in combat. So it kind of introduces this element of, like, knowing when to make use of your time manipulation powers, and knowing you have to recharge them and so forth. But it does add a lot to the game. And, you know, between just the nimbleness of the platforming, of being able to just run at a wall and then you continue running along the wall, that's pretty cool. And you weren't doing that in other video games. You would run at a wall and then you would fall down a pit and die and have to start over. And Prince of Persia was like, no, let's not do that. Let's make it fun to get around, and let's make your character really athletic and not, you know, impose stupid arbitrary limitations on them because of the game engine. Chris.
It definitely hit right at the, like, at the perfect time for the prominence of, like, parkour in pop culture, which is something that I think, again, Assassin's Creed ran with.
Ironically.
No pun intended. But, you know, like, there was a time in this country. We used to be a proper country where every action movie would have a parkour guy in it. To the point where, you know, there's a scene in the Punisher Warzone where there's a parkour guy who gets blown up with a rocket launcher specifically because the director said she was so sick of seeing parkour guys.
It's such a good movie, my God.
So getting that, like, you know, wall running, like, action, the fun movement of that Prince of Persia game was a huge part of it. It was a huge part of what made it fun. Much more so, I think, than the kind of puzzle platforming aspect, which is ostensibly the whole point of the game. But, like, the fact that you could navigate those puzzles in that way was very fun. And again, influenced everything that, like you said, from Assassin's Creed to Arkham Asylum to, you know, what game didn't have parkour in it?
Yeah, I mean, Assassin's Creed whole thing was, one, combat was very parry-based, which we'll talk about, but also it had basically a parkour button. Hold the parkour button and you just do whatever you need to do kind of automatically. It sort of takes an element of control away from the player in the idea of just like making it easy to get around. And Prince of Persia, I think, did a better job of sort of walking the balance between that, where you have a lot of options at your command and you can get around really easily. You're very nimble, but at the same time, it's not just like press button to do everything.
Yeah,
so it's a good balance.
I think it's different. It's with like this game, it's you'll be on a platform and you'll think, okay, to get up there, I've got to run along that wall, dodge those blades, jump across, land on this pole, jump from the pole onto this flag, put my dagger in this flag so I can slide all the way down it as I tear it, jump off onto this wall, and then I'll be at the bottom. With Assassin's Creed, it's more along the lines of, I've got 10 guys after me, what's the most efficient way to get away from them? And then you just kind of hold the R button and aim towards it. And I think it's a different thing. It's a different skill, but mm-hmm. It definitely is evolution into it, but it's a different kind of challenge. And they do put some of the parkour into like Assassin's Creed 2, I recall. There are some areas where you do have to be careful and think about how you're going to ascend, sort of slow climbs. But it is a very different type of sort of cinematic, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's Catacombs in Brotherhood from 2010. That was like, I got into those and I was like, oh, this is what Prince of Persia would be like if they were, you know, kind of still sticking to the style of Prince of Persia. And they were very satisfying in that respect, but those were just like little extra bonuses, and they didn't make a lot of them, and they weren't, you know, by any sense a significant part of the game, but they were fun to experience. Parkour definitely, you know, 2003, we were still 3 years away from Casino Royale sort of putting the definitive statement on parkour in film, and like, here's nimble guy, here is bulldozer guy running through walls behind him. And
I love that scene.
It's
where Bond is just crashing through drywall. It's so good.
Yeah. Like, after that, do you really need another parkour scene in a movie? No. So, you know, it still had 3 years of life. That's how far ahead of its time Sands of Time was, which is not something you usually see in video games. Usually you see a trend like, say, Bullet Time from The Matrix, and then 3 years later, every game has that. And, you know, in a sense, I guess you could say the Sands of Time sort of has that because you can slow down time, but they do so much more interesting things with the concept of time manipulation. It's not just like slowing things down for a cool panning effect. It's, hey, I'm freezing all the enemies around me so I can get easy kills. Hey, I'm slowing down all these spinning gears and swinging, you know, blades so that I can solve this platforming puzzle. It was, I would say where the original Prince of Persia borrowed liberally from Hollywood in a sort of pastiche and homage, like an affectionate nod to classic cinema. The Sands of Time really felt like, hey, this is a game of the moment, grounded very much in what Hollywood is doing. You know, in a way, so was its sequel, 2004's Warrior Within, which did the thing that everyone in Hollywood was doing, which was like, hey, we gave you this likable hero having a fun adventure. Now things are bad and he's really grim and angry and he's going to kill more dudes. And, you know, I think the most I kind of feel like this game's enduring legacy is that Penny Arcade comic where the villainess is talking about, instead of, you know, anything plot relevant, talking about how she's wearing a metal thong that's just incredibly uncomfortable. And that's kind of the game in the nutshell. It just, it really seemed to miss everything that was good spirited and fun about Sands of Time in order to make it more heavy metal, thrashy, angry. Like who asked for that?
It's so weird. It's like the absolute apex of that trope. I think I can't think of a worse. I always say worse. It's not a bad game. It's just wrong.
Let me tell you about Spider-Man 3. Godsmack.
Oh God, yeah. Let's talk about Spider-Man 3. Hell yeah.
I was wondering what Chris would say. He's just pointing at me.
Don't you start with me about Spider-Man 3? Spider-Man 3 is good, actually.
It's an excellent film.
I agree with you.
Okay, good. Then we can.
I mean, it's also bad, but it's also.
Yeah,
good.
Oh yeah, no, it's bad, but it's also one of the best movies ever made.
This is the Shadow of the Hedgehog, the Shadow of the Hedgehog of the Prince of Persia series.
Right. Basically. Yeah. There you go. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, they did not give the prince a handgun, but they might as well have. And the thing is, like, they really took the money
that
they.
Awesome, actually. Yeah,
honestly, I would play that for real.
Okay.
Like, if just all right. One dude was just like, blah, blah. Like, yes. Yeah, let me okay. Play that one.
All right. Comment retracted. No, the thing is, Sands of Time made a lot of money for Ubisoft, and they said, let's put this into the sequel. And they hired some incredible talent. They hired the animator behind The Triplets of Belleville, the movie that should have won an Oscar instead of Finding Nemo. They hired Monica Bellucci right after her memorable appearance in The Matrix, the second Matrix movie. Like, she's a voice actress here. They just threw money at this game. But fundamentally, they made the mistake of saying, well, you know, video games have to grow up now, so everything has to be really dark and angry. Take away all the colors, take away the jokes. It's very serious time. It's very sad.
I feel like that's probably why I never played that sequel. Because I was probably like, yeah, this seems like a bummer.
They did the same thing with Jack and Daxter 2.
Don't, because I love that game.
Yeah, but I mean, did anyone really want angsty, like, science experiment Jack and Daxter?
I mean, it's that point of divergence where after Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, Grand Theft Auto honestly becomes a slog with a bunch of people I hate, and yeah. Saints Row becomes
you don't love your cousin Nico
in the history. No, I don't like Nico,
but you do like
cousin,
Johnny Gat.
Nico Bellic.
I do like Johnny Gat because everybody wants to be Johnny Gat.
Saints Row rules. Let's talk about that.
Saints Row the Third, the best game of all time.
Yeah.
So I think Ubi was sensitive to their goofs with The Warrior Within and tried to kind of walk it back a bit with the final entry in the trilogy, The Two Thrones. They basically were like, hey, Metroid 2 Echoes, that was cool. We should do a Dark Samus. So once again, the Shadow Prince becomes a mechanic, just like in Prince of Persia 2. But he's also like your Venom, and he's in your head talking to you, and you know, eventually you have to fight him in a dreamscape or something.
You transform into him in sort of set points in the game, and while you are him, your health is constantly draining unless you do murders. Because, you know, of course, and the way that
Shinobi,
yeah. But the way you stop being him, which I think is hilarious, is once you get to some fresh water, you splash it on your face by pressing R1. He's like, oh, phew, I'm not mad anymore. Brilliant.
Oh, okay, that's Smeagol. Okay.
Yeah, basically. The Two Thrones, my main memory of that is I did buy that because I liked the previous ones. And I remember thinking, this is the best games will ever look. There will never be a better looking game. It is absolutely incredible at the time.
So
I had that same thought about Super Mario World. Oh, sorry, Kate.
They literally did like a then modern era Jekyll and Hyde. Is that what I'm hearing?
Kind of, but I mean, a lot of games were kind of doing that. And again, like I said, you know, you had Lord of the Rings. So that whole like Smeagol Golem thing, Gollum, it just feels like, again, they were kind of plucking ideas from the zeitgeist and saying, how can we combine this with what already exists in the Prince of Persia sandbox? But you know, the idea of the Shadow Prince as a separate character who is kind of antagonistic to you, again, resurfaces in The Lost Crown. So it's like sometimes they stumbled across some bad ideas. I mean, even like the lady with the metal thong, she's not, there's no one dressed like that in The Lost Crown, but there is kind of like this, you know, antagonistic woman who is kind of always, you're on her heels or she's on your heels. So it feels like, you know, they looked to this trilogy for different elements of inspiration and found them when creating The Lost Crown. So I respect that. Anyway, the series took a little bit of a break here, and they decided to reboot it in 2008 to tie in with the movie. Unfortunately, the movie was delayed, and so this whole thing was kind of a mess, and they just created a game called Prince of Persia. And this time, I feel like they're kind of going with an eco sort of thing, where you have an AI-controlled companion, a woman named Elika. I feel like, what's the Ninja Theory game that does that too?
Enslaved?
Odyssey? Yes, I believe so. Yeah. I think that actually came later than this. So, you know, kind of in the middle of the zeitgeist, I guess. But you know, the imagery of Ico is very much bound into this. And also Shadow of the Colossus, where you're trying to purge the world of darkness with the help of your companion who fights enemies alongside you. And also, if you die, like fall into a pit or something, she'll pull you out. So you never actually have a game over. And then the ending, to spoil it, like you discover that she has to sacrifice herself to bring light back to the world. And you're like, no, I don't like that. So you steal all the light and put it back into her. And the world dies. But at least the lady lives.
So it's kind of a... your Dark Soul light?
She might. She just might.
But then you buy the DLC, and it's fine.
Yes, then you buy the DLC. It's not fine, though. Like, you know, the DLC's whole thing is that she's like, I can't believe you destroyed the world just to save me, you dumbass. Like, my whole mission was to save the world. I sacrificed myself to keep that from happening, and you just ignored it and tried to save me. I didn't want that. So I kind of like that. You know, it's like... Yeah. Again, this is before The Last of Us and The Last of Us Part Two. So
I was about to say The Last of Us.
Yeah, no,
familiar.
I mean, it's yeah, like, you know, it's all well and good to say, oh, I'm going to make a cool, unintuitive decision for the sake of the person I love, but, you know, damn the entire world in the process. And actually having the DLC is nice because you do have to deal with the consequences of that to a certain degree. So. Yeah, I don't know that the reboot was all that successful, but it was pretty well liked. I remember it reviewing well, so that's good.
And I'm going to mention it because it's me. I'm sorry. There's a DS version of it, and it's really fun and completely stylus-based 2D game, and I strongly recommend it.
You just said some things there that I find to be diametric opposites. Stylus-based action.
Oh my! It's a pain. Oh, it's a massive pain in the ass, but I love it anyway because, you know, well, of course I do.
Okay.
Prince of Persia: The Fallen King. You can get it for like a dollar, probably. No one likes it. It's great.
It's Prince of Persia: The Stuart Gyp Edition, is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely!
Like a quirky, interesting game that people will bounce off of, but you see the appeal in it.
All games are good, Jeremy.
I've heard that. I've heard that. Yeah. So anyway, just to kind of wrap up this this hour-long journey through the prelude to The Lost Crown, there is The Forgotten Sands, a final attempt to sort of reboot Prince of Persia. It's actually an interquel with the Sands of Time trilogy.
Interquel,
and this time, interquel, yeah, it's not a prequel. It's not
I
a
love
sequel.
That word, sorry. Every time
it's,
I hear
it's
that
in word. Between two games. It's in between the first and second game. So this is why the prince turned into... a grim, angsty asshole. It's because there was a PSP version. But no, supposedly, from what I've read, this was meant to be an attempt to compete with God of War, as opposed to, you know, like the games that are more spiritually similar to Prince of Persia. So I kind of feel like when you start branching out of that direction, maybe you need to stop and say, is this really what we need to do? It's when you end up with like a Final Fantasy game that's entirely action-based. As opposed to having any kind of menu-driven turn-based elements at all. It's like, is it still that thing? Why not just call it something else or call it? Yeah, I don't know. What are you doing?
It's not really that much like God of War to play. So I don't know why they would swing for that. I hate to say it, but I did really like the PSP version. It was, again, a 2D platformer, which had some interesting puzzles.
Actually, no, I was just bagging on the PSP for the hell of it. The PSP version is actually really good and really feels like the direct predecessor to The Lost Crown. And that's kind of where we were going with me talking about the history of Prince of Persia for an hour, which was eventually you got to a PSP 2.5D exploratory action game and you're like, oh, this could be a future for the Prince of Persia. But it would be another decade and a half before, I guess, a major studio felt like we could put a game like this on a real console as, you know, like a primary title in the series, instead of saying, oh, it needs to be relegated off to the secret, shameful portable zone. Because now portable games are cool because they're the same thing as console games, thanks to Switch and Steam Deck and Switch 2.
It's weird to me that portable games were like looked down upon because Pokemon makes so much money.
But only kids play Pokemon and people who played Pokemon as a kid and who are now adults. But at the time, you didn't have a lot of adults playing Pokemon. So people were like, oh, kids systems.
That money spins, Jeremy. That money spins just as good as anybody's.
I mean, who was the GBA and DS guy in the video games press for like the entirety of the 2000s? It was Jeremy Parrish. That's
where the Metroidvania were.
Exactly. You don't have to defend the honor of portable games to me. I love them. I love portable systems. And a big part of the appeal of The Lost Crown is that I can, in fact, play it on Nintendo Switch or Switch 2, actually, where it's much larger.
I guess
not quite so not so cumbersome as the Steam Deck.
I guess it's because so many portable games in the GBA sort of era were, as you mentioned, versions of console games, which does create the impression of like, okay, here's the real game, and now here's the kind of the kid brother version, as I guess they would say to be derogatory. With Pokemon, it was the opposite, I guess, because the handheld games were the main event, and like the GameCube games, everyone just like moans about.
I do wish that more companies would have taken the approach of, if you're going to do like a console version and a handheld version, just make a completely different game.
Mm.
Like, because some of those turned out really well. Like I believe WayForward did the DS Thor movie tie-in game, which is really good. And the Batman Brave and the Bold handheld game, which is closer to being like the I guess Wii at the time Brave and the Bold game, but like very different in terms of like presentation and art, obviously. But yeah, like there were good games. Like
I think part of the reason that the handhelds were looked down on came from the previous generation, where during the whole initial push into 3D during like the N64 era and stuff, people suddenly lost interest in 2D games because 3D was the new hotness. And so you only got the 2D games on the handhelds, and they were like, oh, these weak 2D games. And I feel like maybe that carried over even in later generations. People were like, oh, those are always the weaker, less graphically whatever games. But you know, then Nintendo, you know, with the Wii, proves that, like, you know, it's more about the gameplay than the graphics. If you're,
I think a big part of,
right.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And also the fact that portable game technology did not really evolve from 1989 through 2001. So you have basically the entire world playing on Game Boy throughout, you know, into the PlayStation 2 era. And there were other systems that had more power than Game Boy, but they didn't really find traction. I mean, Neo Geo Pocket Color was amazing, but 50,000 people bought Neo Geo Pocket Color or whatever. So, you know, it didn't catch on. And so you did have this technology that was growing further and further behind the curve, compared to what consoles were doing. And so you did tend to get simpler games that were geared toward younger players. It was just kind of like this recursive loop But now I think we all understand that portable systems can be and are awesome, and everyone should put their games on portable systems such as Switch, Switch 2, or optimize it for Steam Deck. And if you want to put stuff on PlayStation 5 or Xbox Series, yeah, it's on you. So anyway, let's actually talk about The Lost Crown. And so, Kate, you had recommended we break this into three discussions. I don't know that this game necessarily merits three full episodes, and actually kind of watching the flow of conversation in Discord, everyone kind of seems to feel like the point that you picked as the cutoff for this episode makes a pretty good like halfway mark. It's not necessarily halfway, but that's a lot of it because the game is kind of open-ended. So you can take a few different routes and, you know, go through a lot of optional extra stuff on your way to getting the clairvoyance power-up. So the actual percentage that you clear by the time you get to clairvoyance kind of varies.
It would have really been easier to split up either into two or into four parts, because it feels like the game was structured with four parts. Like there is a story twist that happens at the 1/4 point, that's where stuff starts to diverge. And then
why are they calling this Prince of Persia now?
Yeah. And then there's a halfway point where the diverge stuff comes back. But I was not really thinking that through. I didn't realize how much it diverged. I thought it was still pretty linear. So yeah, we had a lot of discussion with people who went one way. That was the way I thought we were would have been the 1/3 point. And then there's other people who were like went the other way, and they didn't get clairvoyance until pretty much the close to the halfway point. So some people are halfway and some people are third in.
I think, you know, like 3 or 4 hours of conversation about this game feels about right. And that's probably going to be the case for most games. I mean, there are some games where we're going to be struggling hard to get a single episode out of them, I'm sure. But, you know, for this game, I think 2 episodes is just about right. So why don't we talk about the general vibe of The Lost Crown and sort of how it works. Like I was kind of getting at throughout the history of Prince of Persia section, I really feel like The Lost Crown tries to take something from every Prince of Persia game and tries to find something, even in the games that people don't necessarily like that much, and say, well, this part of it was pretty interesting. So let's pull this over. And so you've got a 2D action game that does a lot. There's a lot you can do in this game, and a lot you have to kind of keep track of just in terms of like combat mechanics and weapons and options. There's a lot of systems underneath the whole thing. We might even need to talk about some of that in the second episode. But I do feel like it's important to kind of talk about the play mechanics, because as in The Sands of Time, the combat and exploration mechanics are pretty well integrated with each other. Like they feel like they're very much of a piece, and you're using similar skills and similar techniques to do both things. Like the abilities you use to get around and fight enemies then double for getting around and making your way through the world. And there's a lot of puzzle platforming, a lot of traps and challenges. Like they clearly looked at Celeste and said, oh, that is Celeste is the baby of the original Prince of Persia, so we need to like go the next step beyond Celeste. And I respect that. I actually like the platforming a lot more than the combat, but we can talk about that. Anyway, I've been talking for the past hour, so now someone else is going to talk, and it's not going to be me.
I have a take.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I would like to discuss at this point, because it's not an appearance on Retronauts if nobody gets mad at me for things that I say. I am not a Metroidvania purist. As you know, Jeremy, I declared Super Mario World to be a Metroidvania.
You did.
And I was right.
Oh,
you were.
I was right and correct.
But
we can all admit that now.
But I'm not a gatekeeper on terminology either, so.
Correct.
It's fine. It's good that you believe that.
But I am someone who has a lot of personal tastes. I have played a lot of Metroidvanias. If you're a member of the War Rocket Ajax Patreon, you can read a bunch of little mini essays I've written about Metroidvania. And I will say, I tend to like the ones that are like Castlevania Symphony of the Night, like to put it bluntly. I like the RPG mechanics. I like, you know, getting all kinds of different items and such that do different things. It's one of the reasons that I prefer the Castlevania side of things to the Metroid side of things, because Metroid doesn't have the same kind of like leveling up and equipment management that you get with Castlevania. That doesn't mean that I don't like Metroid. That doesn't mean that I don't like Hollow Knight, which is one of my favorite games of all time, or any number of other Metroidvania. But I will say, it tends to be with me that the further away I get from Symphony of the Night, from Koji Igarashi, the less I like a game. And as beautiful as it is, as interesting as I found the storyline to be, as much as I like the characters, I had a really hard time playing this game because it does a bunch of stuff that I don't like in Metroidvanias.
You have my axe on this, Chris.
I don't like necessary parrying systems. I don't like it when there are enemies that have to be parried, or else, you know, you can't really start or finish a fight. I don't like Metroidvanias where, weirdly enough, where combat is necessary. I don't want to be trapped in an area and unable to leave, a la Guacamelee, when I want the freedom to be able to decide how to approach that combat, whether it's avoid it or engage with it or what. 9 times out of 10, I'm going to engage with it because that's fun. But those elements kind of immediately turned me off this game, which is a game that I was really looking forward to playing, and that I will say, when I was enjoying it, I enjoyed it a heck of a lot. But it did those things where I'm like, that's not the way I like it. And I feel like those are very, I mean, the parrying and dodging and multiple different flags for attacks, like, not every game has to be Dark Souls. You could make some Castlevanias again. That'd be fun.
Yeah, I think I'm in a similar sort of position where when I'm enjoying this, I'm having a blast. Like when I'm enjoying it, but a lot of the time, it did feel like they were specifically trying to annoy me with little small things that bother me. And this game has a lot of stuff to do and learn. A lot of things. I mean, for me, with the combat, once I realized that launching is always the most effective to do it thing anyway, I didn't bother using any of the... I mean, you've got, like, supers that I only ever used on bosses. There was no reason to use them otherwise. But it's the little things that get me in this. And it's going to sound so petty, but, like, you can't run at full speed unless you're holding the trigger. You've got to go into a dash, and you've got to keep holding the trigger. And if you leave an area, you've got to do it again. And that doesn't sound like much, but why didn't they just make you run faster and not have to do that? Like it's not even that much faster.
That's Circle of the Moon nonsense is what that is.
But the parrying was like, I don't mind parrying at all, honestly. I quite like parrying. What I don't like is if you get the parry slightly wrong, you take more damage, I think. As opposed to just being like, okay, like make it a hit or a miss, not a hit or a miss or a really bad miss. It seems weird to me. I don't know. It just missing a parry and getting that freeze effect with like this sort of splutch, like you fucked up kind of thing. It doesn't feel good. I'd rather just take a hit. I'd rather just maybe do a chip damage. But getting brutalized because of parry timing just felt very frustrating. Because of the Dark Souls thing of, you know, you're chugging your own health with your little potions that run out. You don't have much health. It doesn't feel like you have much health.
Yeah.
They copied over the amulets from Hollow Knight, and in Hollow Knight, I don't know, it feels like in this game you take a long time before you're able to wear more or have more useful amulets, and they give you so many of them that are borderline useless that I would always just kind of feel like, I don't. There's like a screen where there's like 60, and I'm like, I'm going to use three of these. And you'd go through like a whole challenge, you'd find a secret area or something, you'd open a chest and it would give you like an amulet that you're never going to use, and I just was kind of like, that's a kind of a bit of a bummer. But again, when I was enjoying this, which was probably most of the time, I was having, I liked it. I just, there was so much about this that I found too long or too much. It just seems like there's so much that you can do, but you don't need to. And that's too many moves. Like, I just found it frustrating and confusing and sending you running all over the place, all the way back to your little hub and to buy six different types of upgrades and such, and I don't know. It just felt maximalist, where like Prince of Persia is so minimalist, you know. It felt like Hollow Knight. They would have things from Hollow Knight because they were in Hollow Knight, not because it felt like they would benefit this.
Yeah, like I'm really glad it's not just me. But also, like, I would never call this game bad.
Oh no, because, no, not at all.
Again,
no.
Most of the time I was really enjoying it, but it teeters on being almost good, which is like the worst thing it can be.
Kate, do you want to step in and defend the game?
Well, actually,
I will call out Chris. You're like, oh, it's stupid for Tomb Raider to have a button that you hold so you don't go sailing off a cliff. But now you're like, it's stupid for Prince of Persia to have a button you hold when you do want to go full bore. Which way do you want it, Chris?
I want to not fall off a cliff, Jeremy. I don't feel like these are mutually exclusive.
Anyway, so, Kate.
Rather than defending the game right away, what I want to say is, first of all, I feel like part of it is that the game is so... We're all saying we think the game is overall good, but sometimes when something is so good, it makes the things that are bad stick out even more. And so then, because you're like, this could have been even better. This could have been even more good if it wasn't for just these little annoying bad things, you know? So I feel like that's part of what's happening. But also, since we're all talking about the things that we didn't like about it, I want to continue to pile on and talk about the thing that I didn't like.
Yeah,
which,
for
me, the thing that almost caused me to not even buy the game was the demo. I played the demo when it came out because I was excited that, like, oh, there's a Prince of Vania, as I like to call it. That sounds right up my alley. But this demo, so I wrote some notes. Let me take a look here.
I will say, while you're looking, Prince of Vania is very, very good. You could just call that a void.
Yes. So when it comes to story in video game, I do not judge story in video games or comics at a different level than I do TV or movies. Some people judge story in video games and comics at like a lower level, like they're more forgiving of it. I don't do that, you know. So when it comes to like story in video games, I'm very sensitive to like just bad writing. And so this demo, you load it up, and is there like, they want to start you with story. They have seven characters standing around expositing at each other. Are they delivering any sort of story hook? Like, no, they're just delivering really pointless information that you don't even need to know at this point. but that they feel like got to set this up. So we have seven people literally standing around delivering lines that are so interchangeable that any of the characters could have been saying any of these lines, kind of like Huey, Dewey, or Louie, you know, like there is literally, they
are. Those were my favorite immortals.
They're not indicating at all any sort of like personality, any sort of like how they know each other, character dynamics or anything. They're just like expositing, standing around. And then once you finally get done with that, you get to run in a straight line for like three screens and then more fucking exposition. And then after that exposition is done, you run in a straight line again and you get to jump like two or three times. And then there's more exposition. Like, this was trying my patience. I was like, this is bad. Like, I already am unsure about this game now. So it's a good thing that after that exposition, I get to run in a straight line and then an entire cutscene of them standing around in the cutscene delivering exposition. And I'm just like, what is happening here? And then, like, after that cutscene, you finally get into some action. You get to fight some people. I'm not even that into combat. I'm here for the exploration. And they kind of hint a little bit. There's, like, a locked door. And it's like, okay, there is, this is going to be a Metroidvania eventually. But the demo was just so completely awful that I almost didn't buy the game. Once the reviews came out and we're all glowing and talking specifically about all of the really good Metroidvania elements, I was like, it must be good. So I want to play this, you know, but that demo, my gosh, was like, that could be taught in a class. I'm like, here's how to not do a demo, you know?
It is okay. Perhaps unfair to constantly compare games to Castlevania Symphony of the Night, which, as you may have heard, is quite good. But I was thinking about that for the entire time that you do that first little tutorial thing, and then you've got to like wander around the castle, and then another conversation and a cutscene, and then it's like finally like, okay, now here's the game. And I was just thinking about like, man, you could have just had us fight Dracula and then the Dark Priest Shaft, tell us about him for like 2 minutes. I even think that's a little too long before you get into Alucard showing up.
Yeah, it was something of the night. Within about a minute, you're like destroying in one hit a dog the size of a room, so that's pretty much peak right there. You know, I found the opening in this game similarly frustrating because I did play the demo a while back, and I really don't want to be too negative because, again, I did actually have fun with this and I'm going to, you know, carry on with it. Everything about the story and the presentation of the story in this game to me was so like, I've seen this shit so many times. I mean, even the cutscene direction, you know, he's going to jump forward, he's going to yell, he's going to do a slash, everything's going to go into slow motion. While he's got a cool expression on his face, then it's going to go back into regular motion again, and then it's going to stagger around a bit, and it's going to keel over. And I could have sat there and written the script out by hand as it happened, and I wish I had, because I think I could probably monetize that skill. But at this point, to be perfectly honest, I'm about ready to skip every cutscene ever. So I'm just kind of over stories.
And I want to be clear.
I want to watch them.
I want to be clear that in the game itself, like the demo, the way that they altered some things like to make the demo flow differently. And what's weird is, first of all, you get to the action faster in the actual game. Like, they have you beating people up like pretty quick after that initial like weird painted cutscene. And the story is like marginally better. Like, the demo I found aggravating. The story in the game I find merely bland, like bland and boring, you know? So like, it's a minor improvement, but yeah, like you're saying, like, I'm still like totally not invested in the story. I understand now, like when I played the demo, I was like, why do you even need seven people standing around expositing when you could, it could be a conversation between two people? You play the game and it's like, oh, I get it. There's seven people because eventually there's story, whatever, you're going to have to like fight them. So when you start like fighting them, you know, I don't feel that invested in them. I'm like, oh, this sucks for my character. But I don't actually feel, I didn't actually feel the twists, you know, that are happening. Yeah. It's like, because it's also just like boring and monotonous, the story, it's, the writing.
I feel like the issues that I have with it overall aren't necessarily like issues with this game specifically. I think they're just AAA problems. I hate saying that because I sound like a dick, but the storytelling in this game, there are so many other games that do this. There are so many other games that use the same sort of direction that I'm just tired of that. And it's a bit of a shame because it feels like something like Sands of Time, which at the time would have been, I guess, the equivalent of what AAA is now. It felt so different. And, you know, the original Prince of Persia was so different and sort of unique. And with this, I just kind of feel like they watched, I don't know, like Avatar or something, and they just kind of copied it. Which, you know, if that's what people want, it seems to be what they want, so who am I to knock it? But for me, it's just all too familiar, and it's a shame because there's so much that I did like here with the, that has all this stuff getting in the way, unfortunately.
Yeah, so since we're all bagging on this, I will get my grievance out of the way as well. And just say, like, if I did not have to play this game for this podcast series, I would have stopped at the demo. Or not the demo, the intro. Because, like, I don't care about the exposition. I tune that stuff out. I don't care. Like, people talk, usually you can skip it or just ignore it. That's fine. But, you know, all of that led up to a boss fight where immediately you are led to understand, oh, it's one of those parry games where the game wants you to perform a very specific sequence of actions in order to overcome different enemies. And if not for the fact that you can totally tune the hell out of the difficulty and the expectations of the game, I don't know if I'd have stuck with it because that's just so annoying to me. I feel like, you know, the Wind Waker came out and gave Link the ability to do cool combat parries and evasions and stuff. And that was really interesting. And then, you know, a few years later, you had a bunch of developers say, we should do that kind of thing, but make it a little more accessible and more streamlined. And so you get Batman Arkham Asylum, you get Assassin's Creed, you get Dark Souls. And those games just made an entire section of game development, that community, the business, just lose their minds and say, oh, well, this is what every action game has to have now. And that's not necessarily the case. It has its place, and I don't begrudge the existence of a FromSoft game. Great. Like, that's what those games are all about, top to bottom. But a game like this, you know, a Metroidvania game where there's so much exploration and navigation and getting around, I don't want to constantly have to stop and fight through a throng of respawning enemies every time I enter a room and perform perfect parries and, you know, just go through the rote of what I'm supposed to accomplish according to the developers and the encounter design they came up with just to go on to the next place and, you know, backtrack to a room that I couldn't reach before, but now I've got a new ability. That's just, it's super frustrating. I don't like meat walls of difficulty when you have a boss that's disproportionately harder than the rest of the combat in a game. Like, you know, Order of Ecclesia was kind of guilty of that, but I persevered because it does have the Castlevania leveling system. This doesn't have that, but it does have the ability to just say, screw all of that. I'm turning the difficulty to super easy. I just want to, like, you know, get around. I feel like the platforming in this game offers plenty of challenges on its own. Like trying to get through rolling spikes and whirring blades and flipping death platforms and who knows what else with, you know, the power of my air dash and my chakram. Like that right there, that's very compelling. That's very interesting. And it feels very true to Prince of Persia. Doing all of that, but then also losing a ton of progress if I don't counter, you know, an arrow attack by some guy picking away at me from off screen while I'm fighting some other guy who's up in my face and having to go back through that gauntlet of challenges all over again. It's not really what I'm here for. So I applaud the developers for recognizing that some of us just don't want to deal with that bullshit and saying, it's okay, you don't have to deal with that bullshit. But for those who do like to deal with that bullshit, you can set the difficulty level so high that no human being could reasonably ever finish this game on those settings. Go for it. God bless.
Yeah, a friend of mine who's been playing through it had said they'd put it onto like the highest difficulty setting, and I was just like, I can't even conceive of being bothered doing that, considering that it's... I guess what the things like Castlevania have that this doesn't is also, you know, options and loot. And yes, there is stuff you can find, but it's all very incremental in sort of a psychologically different way. Whereas in sort of Castlevania, you've got so many different types of weapons you can use. If there's something you're having trouble with, maybe you can switch to some other weapon. But in this, it seems to be more along the lines, if it's something you're having trouble with, either get better at it or just turn the difficulty down. And I don't want to do difficulty discourse, but for me, I feel like that's not very good. I feel like it shouldn't make you do that, but I don't have a very good reason as to why, because I think options are good, and if people want to do that, they should be able to. But it's like I was recently playing Doom the Dark Ages, and I was just finding myself thinking, I don't think this is very well tuned, and it feels like what they're saying to me is, do it yourself. And I don't want to. I don't want to go through all the sliders and find my exact sweet spot. But then also, when I say that, I know it comes across like I'm just saying, this should be for me, and only me. But I don't know how to describe it. Does it make any sense what I'm saying whatsoever? Because I don't want to be the gatekeeper guy, but I also just kind of don't want to go in the menu and fix the difficulty when it didn't used to be an issue.
I think there is, you know, a fair criticism here to be leveled at just the way enemy spawns are tuned. The fact that if you zone out of a room and then duck back in immediately, hey, all those bad guys you just fought are back again. Like that instant respawning, I think really kind of misreads the way a game like this should work. If you look at something like Breath of the Wild, which has the Blood Moon, where all the enemies across the world that you've killed respawn, but they're permanently wiped out until that point, that's a pretty cool way to handle it. You know, the Castlevania games, I think, instantly respawn, but those enemies are almost never that difficult. Mm-hmm. The Metroid games are pretty good about, like, you kill something, and it'll be gone from a room for a little while, but then after time, it kind of respawns, so it gives you some time to go back and forth without having to grind through the battles every single time. I think just kind of pushing it a little more in that direction and giving you some breathing room, not immediately respawning the enemies, I think that would make a huge difference. I don't think the enemies that you fight have to be permanently dead, and that would actually make the game way more difficult because you wouldn't be able to farm, you know, the resources you need. But maybe give players a little bit of space, like 5 minutes or so before the guys come back. That'd be better.
Just sorry, Chris, just real quick. I know. I mean, another thing is that there aren't really fodder enemies in this game. Everything takes at least two or three combos to kill, right? I mean, you can level up and you can get more options, but I mean, after a while, I would just jump over the enemies and be like, nah. Absolutely not. I've had enough of these guys. You know, they'll block you and they'll parry you sometimes, and you got to cycle them and you got to juggle them, and it's the only way I found effective. So I just stopped using any of my other tools because all of them just seem to take longer.
So, Stuart, you just gave me an idea, because you, when you're talking about not wanting to tune it yourself, I just thought,
Very lazy. Yeah.
you know what would be incredible would be, you remember back in the day, you always had to go into options to figure out, like, if you wanted to do y-axis inverted or not. And then one day, like, there were games like Halo that were like made it a part of the story, like, yeah. Hey, what if a game started with an opening level that tuned the difficulty for you? Like, we know that it's possible, like Fortnite, like, kind of tunes difficulty for you to put you into similar matches. Why not have a single player game that has a level that figures it out based on your performance in the opening thing? And then now, there you go.
I would say that's got to be a thing, but I can't think of an example right now. You know, I'm not sure how they would do it.
All right. Chris, did you have something to say?
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, Jeremy, Celeste, which is honestly, in my opinion, like, it is up there with like Tetris as a perfect video game. And that is a game that gives you like a lot of control over difficulty. And obviously there's kind of, you know, like one fail state for Celeste. So that's very easy to account for. But I feel like that game presents its difficulty in a way where you are encouraged to keep playing and you are encouraged to, like, if you turn off dying in Celeste, I feel like most people who do that are eventually going to like turn it back on just to be like, okay, well, can I make this jump? Can I do this? I don't know how to do that. Like, that is essentially magic to me, like the creation of the video game Celeste. But, you know, I went in to turn down like difficulty and like couldn't find the setting because I was like, oh, this is a parry game. And I went in and I know I passed the option at the start of the game to turn a bunch of stuff down and didn't, and felt like a fool. So maybe I was just missing it. Maybe I am.
Maybe
in
the accessibility, like a separate menu, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't remember.
So we're kind of actually running up against the optimal 2-hour mark for this. So I would like to throw it over to the community for the community commentary. And if everyone can open up your show notes that I put together. Oh, it seems like you're all on the page with me. So there we go. We can take turns working through the community commentary. We can talk about the good stuff and the actual game design next time around, I guess. But I want to make sure that our community is integrated here, and they can paint a picture of the game for us. You know, people have been chatting about this game since we announced it back in May? So 2 months ago. So there's a lot of comments. I pulled the most interesting and substantial of them, and sometimes combined comments, multiple comments by various people into a single chunk of text. So I'm not going to read this all myself. We're going to take turns collectively, so it's not just my voice again on this podcast, because no one wants that. But let's see what the community has had to say about Prince of Persia: The Lost Crown, up to the point where you collect the clairvoyance skill, which we haven't actually talked about. Ian Stock says, I love the way this game plays with the general flow of your typical Metroidvania. You don't get the double jump until pretty close to the end. Oh my god, spoilers.
Yeah, big spoiler.
They really want the dash mechanics to shine before they add other movement options. The platforming in this game has a very Celeste-like, tough-as-nails, but respectful-of-your-time feel. A friend of mine described the combat as like a fighting game. Do we agree?
No.
If it was okay. Like a fighting game, I would be having less fun because I am bad at fighting games. But it's definitely halfway there.
In that I am also not good at fighting games, yes.
All right, who wants to read Scott's gigantic comment?
I'll give that a go because we share an initial.
There you go.
Scott says, it was funny hearing the comment about how the last game felt like a proto Dark Souls, because it feels like it fits square on the other side of the Dark Souls phenomena in that it's a Metroidvania that has borrowed heavily from Souls, specifically in its combat and progression. The save points that refill your limited healing potions, as well as that same sense of, can I make it to the next save point, etc., which I actually really don't like here. It's maddening to venture off from the save point to take an errant shot from something to have to turn around and heal back up to do it again. You are very fragile, and one hit can make the difference. The regular enemies are absolutely frustrating here. Huge damage sponges that can take a surprisingly large amount of damage to kill, and having to recognize whether I have to dodge or parry, or if it's the special parry or whatever, it's all too much for what I look for in combat from a Metroidvania game. Having to memorize your character's combos in addition to parry timings and which attacks to parry and blech, not for me. I think that's what that is, blech. I don't know. And this is why I'm so frustrated, because the platforming is so fucking good. It's fast and precise, and you have just enough at your disposal to really move around through the air very gracefully. Jumping into dashes, into wall jumps, into slides, into jumps, into dashes, it's so fluid and seamless and feels great. But then comes the exploration. The map is huge. The fast travel points help some, but multiple times I've run off to explore what seemed like a new area, did a lot of running to get there, only to find it wasn't actually the right area, and now I just have to turn around and walk all the way back. I was very surprised by how big the early areas are in that way.
Chris, you want to read what Guillermo J said?
I'll do that. We share an initial as well.
Hey!
The only thing I'd add to the Lost Crown is a Super Metroid-style mini-map in the corner, so you don't need to pause every time you need to check something in your immediate vicinity. Weird that a game with this many accessibility features doesn't have that. Is the Lost Crown the first Metroidvania to allow you to put screenshots directly on the game map? It's a great feature, and I expect a lot of games to copy it if it hasn't happened already.
That's nice.
Hard agree on that.
Yes, I want every
definitely.
Game to have
that's a good.
It was great, yeah, and I think it is the first.
Especially like, look, we all love that gate shaped like Ridley or whatever.
Mm.
But the bigger the game gets, the handier it is to have ways to remember things.
I am amazed if this is the first game that's had it, because it's the first one I can recall. I'm amazed it hasn't happened before, because it just seems like such a no-brainer. Like, yeah. You have something marked on your map, sure, but what the hell was it? Is it this kind of gate or this kind of gate? And then this, you can just look at the screenshot and go, ah, no, it's that. I can't do anything with that yet. I won't go there. That is top tier.
Yeah, I think it's just an evolution of things you saw. Like, Order of Ecclesia had icons that you could put on the maps.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of differentiate that way. But it relied a little bit on sort of your internal filing system. And you kind of had to keep track of like, oh, I put this kind of icon there. What does that mean? Whereas this is much more straightforward. And yeah, it's a real boon to the game, I think. Kate.
All right. Jigasubasix says, about half an hour through the opening, enjoying the flow of things, kind of, sort of getting the hang of parrying a little, but using the analog stick for 2D platforming just makes no sense to my brain. I suppose I have plenty of time to acclimate. I saw someone mention Hollow Knight above and made sure to go with make my map as useful as possible, please, in the starting options, just in case it was like Hollow Knight in that way. That game was a nightmare and I constantly felt lost. I did not like the intro. I realized they had to teach combat since it matters a lot, but it felt rather forced emotionally and doesn't seem to have much to do with the point of the game. I know in media res is the way narratives tend to work these days, but man, that's a lot of dead people to be a tutorial.
Jimmy Shannon said, very grateful the game allows you to just retry bosses rather than make you take the path there every time. If I'm really invested in the world and atmosphere, like in Dark Souls, getting back to the bosses and internalizing enemy patterns on the way is a really interesting, rewarding experience. If I don't particularly care about the world, it's the quickest way to burn me out on your game.
Galbana says, just got the bow. Combat got some time to get used to, but I'm having fun. It's slightly mean they entice you to all these alternate paths, but following the main one is the only one that leads you to a hub, giving essential combat pointers stroke upgrades. I honestly feel the game is more fun not buying the maps from the girl who sells them. They just kind of spoil what's in front of you and don't even give meaningful direction. It's a lot more fun to just wander around yourself. And yes, I also know she eventually sells treasure maps with locations for all the treasures, which I think Stu might make at least one snide remark about in one of the episodes. I don't know what you're talking about.
Jimmy Shannon also says, I have reached my Metroidvania kill screen where I quit all of these games, which is the third time I have done a loop of the current area, unable to find any way to proceed. Walkthroughs are often not helpful for this genre because if you don't follow them from the start, it's hard to open one and know where the relevant information is because you don't know what you've missed. It seems like the game really holds your hand on a narrative level, characters telling you where to go, but I was directed to the archives and I did a good amount of exploring and then every potential path was blocked. I don't think any story beats occurred to tell me to go somewhere else. I tried the depths again, but that also led to a dead end. So, I mean, maybe that's a mark in favor of the girl selling you maps and giving you pointers.
I will say, I really do like the phrase, the idea of having a personal kill screen. That's very fun. Jimmy, that's a good bit. I don't mind getting lost, though. Like, I loved Animal Well. I did get to the point where, like, I was finished with Animal Well, and Animal Well was not finished with me. Uh-huh. But that was fine.
Having put together a strategy guide for Axiom Verge 1 and 2, I can tell you that making a coherent, cohesive, well-organized strategy guide for a pretty open-ended game with plenty of backtracking is really, really hard. And coming up with a visual language to help kind of filter through that was an immense challenge, one of the hardest things I've ever done in terms of publishing. So I sympathize for anyone who is given $25 and a bag of popcorn in order to write a complete strategy guide for a site like IGN. They're brave people and they're running on fumes, and I respect them. Anyway, on to JB's brother's wizard friend.
Oh, I love that guy.
I'll do this one if that's okay.
Yeah.
What are people's positions on parrying? It was a sticking point in Metroid Returns / Dread, and you really do need to parry to fight some enemies, but it feels like there are more options available. Or maybe it's that enemies don't occupy intense platforming puzzle spaces. My position on parrying, negative.
It's my position.
It's fine.
I think we've
it's
talked
fine
about
as an
it
option.
Kate, do you want to go with what Scott had to say?
The funny thing is I love Third Strike. Parrying in fighting games, yay. Parrying in Metroidvanias, ooh. I have heard a larger conversation going on of how Souls and wanting to be like Souls has become too pervasive in modern game design. And I do look forward to games like this and Clair Obscur as examples. They are games that have things about them that I truly enjoy, but their inclusion of Souls-esque mechanics feel like they hold them back rather than add to them.
Yeah, there's a whole conversation that I screenshotted from Discord talking about this. Just to kind of summarize it, Guillermo J. said that they enjoy parrying in The Lost Crown. It seems intuitive, and there are defensive and offensive moves, so you don't have to depend on it.
Can we each take one person's role and do a dramatic reading? I think that would be a lot.
Okay.
I was Guillermo before. So
could right, I Guillermo be Michaelis and give them Yogi Bear's voice?
Yeah. I'll do Jimmy Shannon again.
And I'll do Jigsaw 6 again.
And it all works out.
How dramatic do you want this to be, Kate?
As like 11.
I enjoy parrying. In The Lost Crown seems pretty intuitive to me, yet there are so many defensive and offensive moves you never need to depend on it. Also, enjoy parrying in Metroid Dread.
I like parrying more in Samus Returns, but maybe it's because I was better at it.
I liked it in Samus Returns, too. But you can combo it far better on Dread.
Haven't played Dread yet, boo-boo.
I have about a 50.1 success rate, 50.1% success rate with parrying, which is all I need for it to feel like a viable mechanic instead of something to be ignored completely, like how I play Dark Souls games.
Jeremy, how's your accent work?
My accent? Was that supposed
your
to be an accent?
Work? Yeah, can you maybe give us a little bit, like a little more?
I have about a 50.1% success rate with parrying, which is all I need for it to feel like a viable mechanic instead of something to be ignored completely, like how I played Dark Souls games.
Okay, so we got Yogi and we got Huckleberry Hounds. We nearly got a Laugh Olympics here, people. Okay. I'm bad at parrying anything that's not telegraph with yellow stink eye, buddy bear.
Let's hear what JB's Wizard's best brother's friend had to say.
Is this me again?
Sure, but in your normal voice.
I'm really vibing with the combat difficulty and wide variety of encounters. I like the cadence of a Metroidvania. That is, the incremental exploration and new powers function both as keys and new ways to move slash fight. But until relatively recently, Metroidvanias have never incentivized difficulty, so your powers feel superfluous. Even early Metroid, so much of the difficulty is overcome by tanking damage because the enemies largely just run into you. And Igavania becomes a game of how many potions can I stock up before the next fight. I don't know if it was Hollow Knight specifically that innovated on that. I'm just going to call them this in honor of Paper Mario. Badges. But being able to customize your kit beyond just making a flat number go up has gone a long way to making both the jumping and fighting engaging. It really worked well in Dread for me. By the time you get a super gun to kill the murder robots and the game achieves a level of difficulty on par with Super Metroid, and the final boss was the most fun to fight encounter in series history for me. It actually felt like an epic anime fight worthy of Samus's struggle. Lost Ground's regular goons are harder than any boss so far. TBH.
I don't agree with that at all. What about that dog lady or whatever it was? Look, you have to keep parrying in different directions, and if you got it wrong, you just get murked. Oh boy.
Hey, so Runner's Dial Zero says, I'm stoked to hear the episodes on this game. I started it shortly after it came out, and it did the thing I always do when I drop off for a while and came back to it. I fired it up the other day at 78% and thought I'd clean up some of the remaining unexplored areas and get a few more upgrades before hitting the final boss. Turned out I was right on the boss's doorstep, so I went out and got my final health upgrade. Then went back and beat it in one try, which I wasn't expecting since the midpoint boss of the game nearly had me quit out of frustration. It's a shame that this team was wiped out so soon after finishing the game. It's a fantastic Metroidvania, and I would have loved to have seen them continue making games together. It controls beautifully, and they really knocked it out of the park. The combat could be a little too challenging for me at times, mostly because I suck at parrying, but there's enough ways to work around your personal limitations by way of medals, health upgrades, accessibility options, and the combined freedom of movement and combat options that it makes it so good. If only Team Cherry had a similar design ethos, I will finish Hollow Knight. I will never finish Hollow Knight. Excuse me.
There was a lot of bagging on Team Cherry in the Discord, but we won't proliferate that. Let's do one more round of comments of readings by each person, and then bring this thing home, and then prepare for episode 2, where we actually talk about the game and not just why we hate the game. So JB says, I've seen nothing but love in this thread, and first impressions are, it has supplanted everything else in my platonic ideal of what a Metroidvania is. So I'm interested in hearing whatever negativity you've come across, and ideally, if those same people also dislike Hollow Knight.
Yes.
To summarize my thoughts, this game steals from everywhere, yet somehow coalesces into a coherent whole, which is kind of where Igavania began. I'm trying to identify the genre's jus, and I've come to this hard-to-describe feeling of progression. Few other genres, even RPGs, have this spark that wells as you start with nothing and end up on top of the world. Maybe it's because, from the very beginning, you can see the locked doors and the keys also expand your moveset. I wonder how an RPG can translate that same feeling of progression without obvious gating, like powerful monsters. How do you express to players in this other genre? In other genres, you can go here eventually. I vibe with The Lost Crown more than Blasphemous, and I vibe with Blasphemous a great deal, as a game that couldn't decide if it wanted to be a Souls game or Vania. Another Metroidvania with anemic enemies, and you move far slower than I prefer. Lost Crown feels mostly iterative of Hollow Knight, but that game is on the opposite end of the spectrum, where you're light as a feather, and a lot of the combat meta for me was filling up the suspicious white liquid gauge and hoping a boss would give me a 3-second break to heal. Hollow Knight's badges also felt particularly weak. I've been switching up quite a bit in Lost Crown, and create a time bubble on parry has a lot more juice than Hollow Knight's, which largely exists to make your stats incrementally better and to show you on the map. So, one vote for much better than Hollow Knight. So, I'll let someone take Porifera. We've been building up to their comments. They always have a lot to say about Metroidvanias.
Shall I do Porifera?
Yeah.
Do Porifera. I just want to say I'm just not on board with all this Hollow Knight bug in. 10 out of 10 game.
Yeah, Hollow Knight's amazing. What is going on?
Well, you know, I don't want to say it, but you know what I'm thinking? Anyway, Porifera says, this game's combat system and enemy design aren't quite good enough for so much of the game's design to be resting on them. Still, I'm sure this team could iterate and make something a lot better with a sequel. Now I'm going to take a big sip of coffee and start reading about the general state of the game industry. I don't want to be mean to this game because the more I play it, the more I find to like the emphasis on puzzle platforming that's pretty unique in the Metroidvania space as far as I'm aware. It's a million little things that I imagine wouldn't be as big of a deal if I were playing on a lower difficulty. Animation clarity is a problem, lack of interesting enemy behaviors, lack of crowd control options despite combat encounters featuring lots of crowds, sponginess. I've been playing like 5 or 6 hours at this point, so I wouldn't be surprised if things coalesce a bit better as I go along. It does feel unique doing this juggly type of combat in this genre. I really wish they would have been given a chance to iterate. I keep comparing it in my head to 3 other non-Metroid, non-Castlevania, well, kinda, Metroidvanias I've played. Momodora, Reverie Under the Moonlight, Bloodstained, Ritual of the Night, and Blasphemous. In so many ways where it can be directly compared, it comes up short, but I appreciate the ways in which it's unique.
I would agree with all 3 of those because I like all 3 of those games more than I like this one so far. Momodora is really fun.
Oh, yeah.
That's a candidate for the future. Chris, do you want to tackle Spencer C?
No, I want to do Roused Hour Save Us.
Okay. Kate, do you mind?
I can do Spencer C.
All righty.
One thing I found that I don't like about this game is that there seem to be quite a few places that seem like they want you to try and get to with various methods of jumping, climbing, only to find nothing. I wish there was more hidden rewards to find tucked away in the corners. I am a fan of that as well.
And Chris?
I wanted to do this one because I like the movie. The Mystery Science Theater episode from which the name Roused Hour comes. I'm having a great time so far. Yeah, the combat can take a little bit to get used to, especially as all the buttons fill up with different combat moves, but luckily the options provide enough flexibility to make it enjoyable to anyone. Platforming is top-notch. I really enjoyed the platform puzzles of the depths, and the Shadow and Rush simmered powers really make the level exploration work for me.
Should I repeat my role as peripheral?
Sure, bring it home for us, Stuart.
Am I missing something, or is the healing in this game really stingy?
Missing something.
Unrelated, I'm about a quarter of the way through, which feels like a very, very little, considering I put in like 9 hours so far, but whatever. Something this game is good at is creating navigationally distinctive and interesting zones. This is something that a lot of Castlevania games struggled with. I feel like the real reference point would be something like Hollow Knight or Ori and the Blind Forest, but what I heard going in is that this game dips into a lot of Metroidvania stuff without having a strong identity on its own, and I was curious how it would feel without any strong familiarity with the games it's drawing from. So far, I'm like 50-50 on that assessment. As someone who isn't an expert in it, but really likes the history and mythology of the ancient Near East, I give this game a lot of points for being about that. I wanted to do a big that for the end.
Very good.
Thank you.
So, we're out of time for this episode, and we haven't really talked about Prince of Persia: The Lost Crown, how it works as a game, although the community did kind of step in to help flesh that out. Had I known that we were going to spend more than half an hour just talking about how much we hate the combat and how frustrating it is, as opposed to just kind of like passing on or like touching on that and then moving along, I would have structured this episode differently. But, you know, you live and you learn.
It could work, because next time is just going to be a pure positivity.
Well, I mean, next time is just going to be us talking, you know, in depth about the entirety of the game. So maybe a bit longer than usual, but I think it will be, you know, this was like the prelude episode. This was the demo. I'm sorry if you don't love the free demo that you just downloaded, but I promise if you pay for the full game, it's much better. It's not just seven people expositing. It's a full adventure, a full journey into Prince of Persia: The Lost Crown. You never know how these things are going to go. So this was not the episode that I expected, but it was still a good conversation, very interesting, and I would say certainly heartfelt. So thank the three of you and also the community for chiming in. And we'll be back in a few weeks, couple of months, I don't know, to, I think, bring it home and wrap up Prince of Persia: The Lost Crown. And if it did sound like we were being kind of negative here, please understand that there was the constant refrain that, yes, we find these things that we're talking about frustrating, but that was kind of like getting it all out of the way, because there's a lot that we like about the game. And I'm glad that Kate encouraged us to play this game, because, you know, once I kind of got over the fact that the game wants me to fight people all the time and figure out how to mitigate that, like the exploration, the puzzles, the platforming, the flow, the skill acquisition order, and kind of the openness and flexibility of it all, it's all very satisfying. Like I see a lot in this game that I like, and I'm looking forward to clearing out the back half of it and completing it. And I do think that, you know, when we get together next time, the tone of the episode will be much more positive and upbeat, because there's so much good stuff in The Lost Crown. We just had to, you know, get our caveats out of the way, I think. So thank you, Kate, Stuart, Chris, and community, for weighing in. You are now free to advance to the end of the game. It's a spoilers for all. No spoiler warnings whatsoever. Just spoil the hell out of everything. It's no holds barred. So dig in and get ready for the next episode, which will be along before too long. Jump into the Metroidvania conversation channel on our Discord and share your thoughts with one another and with us. You too could be famous on Retronauts, possibly sounding like Yogi Bear.
Thank you for
so anyway. Yes, of course. This has been Retronauts episode 705. That's a lot of episodes, and we're going to keep making episodes. If you want to enjoy the 704 other episodes that we've made so far, I encourage you to go to retronauts.com or check out pretty much any digital delivery platform besides Spotify, because we're there. And you can listen to us. You can also support this podcast and help us to make future episodes, 700 more, maybe more than that, by going to patreon.com/retronauts and subscribing to the show. If you subscribe at the, what is it, $2 a month level, then you get early access to episodes without advertisements. That's awesome. But if you subscribe at the $5 a month or higher level, then you can join the Discord and talk about this and future Metroidvania games, among other things, with us. You can banter with me about prog rock if you want. That's a special Discord exclusive just for you, the cool Retronauts subscriber. Patreon.com/Retronauts. That's my pitch. Now I'm going to let other people make their pitches. Kate, please pitch at us.
Oh, hello. I'm Critical Kate Willard. You can find me on the internet by searching Critical Kate on Blue Sky or YouTube or possibly even Google sometimes. I research and write about forgotten video game history.
Chris Sims.
What do you can find me? by going to the-isb.com. That's my website. It's got links to all the stuff that I do, including the weekly War Rock and Ajax podcast, which is about comics, pop culture, and swords. We are spending a good chunk of this year rating swords submitted by our listeners. So if you want to know where the Dragon Slayer stacks up against the Batleth, or the Master Sword stacks up against the Moonlight Greatsword, it's the show for you.
Is a Batleth a sword, not a polearm?
There's no pole in a Batleth, Jeremy. Come on.
You gotta hold on to something.
It's all metal. It's all metal. It's a sword. I did have a debate with a friend over whether
what do you put a flag on? You put a flag on a metal pole. Come on.
I did have a debate over whether it was a sword or an axe with a friend, but a polearm, come on.
It's like a sort of a semicircle that you sort of wield, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a
chakram.
It's like a giant knuckle duster that you hold with both hands with spikes on it.
Yeah, bad sword.
But bad sword. Having said that, haven't listened to the episode, so I can't comment, obviously. You know.
You can also, if you want me to make things up about people in your video game, you can hire me to do that, too. Just go to my website, like I said.
All right, and Stuart Chip.
Yes, hello. I'm Stuart Chip. You can hear me mostly on Retronauts. You can read my book, All Games Are Good, which I plugged earlier in the show. And it's obviously a tremendous book, which, you know, I would say that, but it is. And also I'm going to be at Long Island Retro Gaming Expo Convention this year, which is genuinely terrifying. But if you want to come up to me and say nice things about Mary Hell, you can feel free. I'll be delighted. Don't talk to me about video games, though. I'm not interested. Thank you.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on the internet. At this point, I don't think I need to promote my videos because people know me more for my videos than for Retronauts, which seems wrong. But my face does appear in my videos, so that's probably why they're like, oh, it's that guy. I recognize that, you know, the fact that he looks like a 1914 Irish newsboy. The one and only Jeremy Parrish. So, yeah, check out my videos on YouTube or just listen to Retronauts. You'll get your fill of me no matter what. But until then, there are more Retronauts episodes coming your way along the internet. Look forward to them. And please subscribe to the Patreon because that's how we make the things. They don't get made for free because we got mortgages to pay. Oh, my God. That's it. We'll be back to talk more about The Lost Crown before too long. Kate, can you do Snagglepuss?
What does Snagglepuss sound like again?
Heaven the Murgatroyd.
Absolutely.
Harry is not. I don't think I can do Snagglepuss without some prep.
You got to get that quaver in the voice. Yeah,
I think it's like I think Snagglepuss is a little bit like close to what's his name? Pairing is not optional here at all. I think.
Is that a Christopher
Okay, that was Baroness. Walken? That's pretty good.
That was like trying to do a walk-in, because I think walk-in is like you can almost get to a Snagglepuss from a walk-in, kind of.
I just want to do it. I want to have a go at Snagglepuss now, but it's already quite long, you know. Parrying is not optional here at all. It's not that good. It's not
Parrying's
good.
Not optional here at all.
Okay, I think we went off the rails with this. Let's
to Metroid.
Let's.
That's. That's good stuff. That's good stuff.
That's my best joke in the whole show.